open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
I, when I did it, regarded the tree differently when I was up in it in that way. I felt it is a sentient being, but it has a very, very slow metabolism.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. On today's program, author and filmmaker Garth Stein. His latest book, A Sudden Light, begins from the perspective of a 14-year-old boy. Stein is fascinated with this stage of life at the edge of adulthood.
They're still very innocent in the way they still don't have the life experience to understand certain things. There's the energy of trying to discover and yet not the understanding that what they discover may be painful.
Garth Stein's book, The Art of Racing in the Rain, has sold more than 4 million copies, and it spent 3 years on the New York Times bestseller list. He's interviewed this hour by Sarah Barrip Neal, a journalist and fiber artist from the Glen Arbor Artists Association. Stein starts off the hour talking about going to film school at Columbia University.
While I was at film school, a buddy of mine said, hey, can you produce my film for me? And it was his thesis film, and so we made it. It was called The Lunch Date, and it went on to win an Academy Award in 1990. But Adam, my buddy, Adam Davidson, it was his award, so he went up to get the statue and everything, and I was up in the audience, and he came out to accept his award, and he gave his speech, and he said, I'd like to thank my co-producer, Garth Stein, who's up there somewhere. And my mother got 12 telephone calls from relatives and friends wondering when I had died.
Well, we're glad that you're resurrected to be here today.
Yeah, well, sorry.
That's sorry. A wonderful
story.
But
it was funny that you, wherever you are.
Wherever you are.
There is always a connection. We just may not see it.
Welcome to Traverse City.
Oh, well, thank you.
Glad you're here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's jump right in and talk about A Sudden Light. New novel. Multi-generational saga set in the Pacific Northwest. No great surprise, timber, logging, and conservation issues are right in the core of it. So give us a quick synopsis and then we'll move from there.
Yeah, you can't talk about the history of the Northwest without talking about trees. I mean, you all know this in this area. Most of the history of the Northwest I find quite fascinating. If you go back to the glacier times, obviously we're talking millions of years, and Native Americans, the first Native Americans were in the Northwest along the mm-hmm. Pacific coast, so tens of thousands of years. And then, but if you talk about white people, there was 1851, there were no white people, and 1852, there were white people. I mean, it was just as simple as that. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of a cowboy town until the late 1800s, when money started coming in from this area. When they had cut enough trees here, they needed more trees. So they moved west, and that's when the culture of Seattle started to get developed. So my book is set against that idea of when culture had to start. It's a multi-generational family saga, so it's set against the timber industry, but one bookseller told me it's epic yet intimate, which is, I guess, what I was going for. You know, it's got a lot of range of the history of the Northwest, but it's also really, at its core, about a son who wants his parents to stay together, and they're going to get divorced. And he's trying to figure out how he can keep them together, and the only way he can keep them together is by unraveling the mysteries and the deceit that is in the Riddell family history, and so that's what he has to delve into.
Well, the epic saga end of it is the moving back in time too. You're going back to the forebears, and it has all the hallmarks of epic sagas: great turmoil in the family, confusion, secrets.
Yeah, I mean the idea that it starts with the Elijah Riddell, who is our father figure back starting in 1874 or whatever when he first comes out to the Northwest, and of course he has a son and he wants what we all want of our sons. We want our sons to be really well-educated and bright. We want them to maybe be able to play a musical instrument or to dance, at least a foxtrot. Mm-hmm. We want them to be well-read, to be able to be able to mix a drink, to be quick with a retort in an intellectual party. We want them to be just like us, but better. And so Elijah sends his son Benjamin Riddell off to Yale University in 1890 to be educated, and because that's where one of the first forestry schools was established. Now it wasn't the first, but it was among the first half a dozen forestry schools. And at that time, you had a forestry school in order to learn how to manage the assets of. It wasn't about conservation, it was about managing the assets of the timber. But what else was going on at Yale at that time? The ideas of the transcendentalists, you know, the ideas of John Muir, who was doing a lot of writing at that time, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau. And so these ideas infiltrated Ben's mind. He comes back not just educated in how to manage a forest, but also with the spiritual understanding that we are all connected.
Did you know all this before you started?
No.
Okay, so was this a lot of Wikipedia research or?
You know, Wikipedia is an evil force in this world. No offense to Julian Assange, but it's not necessarily reliable, but it is important for one to do research. For me, I hate research. I hate reading books. Did I say that out loud?
That's a ringing endorsement for reading from a...
No, novel. What I mean is, I learned how to do research in high school. I used the osmosis method. Mm-hmm. You pile the books on your desk and...
Sleep on it?
If they sit there long enough...
It'll transfer.
Right. You just get it. For me, the important part is the drama of a piece of fiction, not what coins sounded like when they were jingling in someone's pocket. Mm-hmm. So I'm not that interested in that, but when I get drawn to it, I do. So I liken writing a book to, I liken it to pushing a rock up a hill, right? So if I'm a writer, I'm starting by using my own ideas, my own willpower to try and get something started. I'm starting a book right now, and I'm like, you start pushing it up the hill. When you get it up to the big rock up to the top of the hill, it gets to the top, and then it starts to roll on its own. And at that point, you as a writer have to be wary and be respectful and be listening for what's going on, because when it starts rolling down the other side, it's not about the writer, it's about the rock. Mm-hmm. So what happened with me with writing A Sudden Light is that I started doing something that I thought I was meant to be doing, and I got the rock up to the top and it started rolling down the hill, and then I was like, wait, it's telling me, the book is telling me what it wants to be, so now I have to go do research.
So the map is not the territory, the book took on a life of its own and started.
Yes.
And so you're willingly following it?
I like to think of myself as a steward,
a willing co-conspirator.
A servitor. Uh-huh. You know, look. I mean, if you go, I mean, this was A Sudden Light. Is this? But even more so, it was more exaggerated when you go to The Art of Racing in the Rain, where uh-huh. You know Enzo basically dropped in and said, "Okay, you type, I dictate." Mm-hmm. You know, which is a weird, mystical, strange experience, and it's wonderful, but you can't count on it.
So you do have to show up.
Sometimes you have to actually.
Okay. A Sudden Light is set in an ancestral home. It's built by Trevor's great-great-grandfather. Trevor is the 14-year-old narrator. You've invented a fantastical place in this Riddell house. A dozen chimneys, more than 100 windows, secret stairways, rooms, a library of rare books, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And and I'm quoting you here
from
your book. The pillars that encircle it, it being the house, and made up much of its exterior walls, were tree trunks, fully grown giant trees, stripped of their limbs and clad in the bark they were born with, each one a perfect specimen. And after I read that, I wondered, what's the precedence for a home like this among the timber barons in the 19th century? Is Riddell House modeled after anything, or is that
Yes and no. It is, and yet it's also a spin-off on my own. I mean, the timber barons, as you know, were immensely wealthy, and they could build whatever they wanted to build. And they built some amazing houses, especially in this neighborhood that I grew up near in North Seattle called the Highlands, which is what I've based the North Estate on. When I was doing, but then again, I created this world and I thought, well, I need to now do some research to figure out what the world is really about. And that's when I came across some interesting research. In 1909, there was the Alaska-Yukon-Pacific Exposition in Seattle, and it was a big celebration. It was located where right now the University of Washington is, in Montlake. At that time, the University of Washington was in downtown Seattle on, guess what, University Avenue. Why they would name it that, I don't know. But that's where it was. But then when they were doing they did this exposition, they built all these buildings and pavilions to house this exposition, which was quite a big success. One of the buildings they built that is no longer there is the U.S. Forestry Pavilion. And they wanted to really show off the power and the strength of the Northwest forests. So they went and they found these amazing, perfect specimens of Douglas firs, and they cut them down. And they brought them in and used them as pillars with the bark. And I have this website, asuddenlight.com. You can go and see photos of, it's no longer there. They built this building and it was really quite impressive, but they didn't do anything to protect the wood from disease wood beetle. Beetles got into it and ended up eroding the inside of these pillars. And so they had to tear it down so it wouldn't kill anybody. So it's no longer there, but there are photos that exist. And I thought that is when I saw these photos, I thought that's my house. Mm-hmm. Because it's an homage to the forest. It is, in a sense, carving the way, metaphorically carving our home out mm-hmm. of the forests.
Mm-hmm. Trevor, our narrator, he's been taken by his father mm-hmm. to visit the ancestral home, Riddell House, where the father grew up. It's the summer of 1990. Trevor's along for the ride, albeit unwillingly, and he's distracted by his parents' marriage, which is on the skids.
Yes.
Sorry, guys, about that noise. So they arrive, and early in the novel, we're introduced to, with Trevor, some of his relatives, his Aunt Serena, his grandfather Samuel. And I was reading this, and every time I would read the dialogue from that Serena was speaking, I would want her to have a Southern accent. Because these people are right out of the Tennessee Williams Guide to Family Dynamics.
Yes. Yes,
they are. Unreliable, unsettling bunch.
Yes.
You've invented.
You know, that's very funny. Do you have more?
No,
Can I respond to that?
If you must.
Yeah. Because, so Serena, Aunt Serena is like this, Trevor's like, oh, I'm going to go meet my aunt, and he's figuring, oh, she's going to be like old Doughty, Mrs. Doubtfire
she's
or something.
So hot. Right?
And she's not. She's smoking hot. She's 35 years old. She's flirting with him constantly. She wears these dresses, full cleavage, and she always takes her shoes off. She doesn't wear shoes in the house, so she's always showing off her perfect feet and her exquisitely
pedicure.
Painted blue toenails uh-huh. that just are mesmerizing for a 14-year-old boy. And she's always jousting with him. And so, and I was writing this character, and when the book was at a stage where I was giving it out to my close circle of readers, they would say, oh, well, clearly this is Blanche DuBois, Tennessee Williams, mm-hmm. right, from A Streetcar Named Desire. And I had to do a lot of thinking about that. I said, because I never thought of her as that. And I really had to actually go and like write like a my own private college essay on Blanche DuBois, because Serena is not Blanche DuBois. Blanche DuBois was damaged in a very different way than Serena. Serena was damaged much earlier when she was 11 years old. Something very tragic happened in the history. I'm not going to spoil it for you here if you haven't read the book. But she was very, and then her brother was sent away, and she built up a mythology about her brother that is, it's surreal in a weird way. And so I tried to do a little bit more channeling of where I came up with this whole thing and how this whole dynamic comes, because Grandpa Samuel is another odd character. You know, does he have dementia or not? He's old and cranky and mean, but yet sometimes he's really sweet and disarmingly friendly. And that's when I did a lot of theater when I was growing up. When I was in high school and stuff, I acted tons, and I spent a lot of time reading plays. I think reading plays is very, very valuable for a writer, especially Tennessee Williams. Mm-hmm. You read Tennessee Williams, I mean, sure, you can go see a Tennessee Williams production, probably will be inferior to what you hope, but if you read, his writing is so good in how he writes the scenes and stuff, it really comes alive. And so I was like, so where did this influence come from? And it came to me that it was A Moon for the Misbegotten by Eugene O'Neill. And you can find it, you know, you go on, you can read it, of course, but if you go on YouTube, you can look for it, because they did a, you know, one of those Pennsylvania oil hours or something. You know, it was sponsored by some big company. And it was, they shot it with Jason Robards as the lover and Colleen Dewhurst as Jesse. Yeah? And that's the combination, the relationship between Jesse and her father, that's the relationship that I saw Serena and Grandpa Samuel. This like, it's bitter and they're at each other constantly, but that's all this part, but the underneath the surface, they really love each other like so exquisitely and fundamentally, they will never leave each other. It's, they cannot.
It's got the whiff of Southern Gothic.
Yeah.
It's a complex bunch of relatives.
Well, yeah, I mean, I like that idea. I'll go with that.
We'll let it stand. At the base of this particular novel is another struggle between the timber baron father and his conservation-minded son, who, among other things, is a climber of tall trees. Oh, yeah. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you researched the tree climbing detail and what lengths you went to?
So I mentioned, I said Ben got sent away to Yale to get educated. He comes back, and he and his father says, now you're working for the company, and you're going to take over for me. But Ben doesn't want to. He wants to go work in the field. He wants to be with the trees because he feels this attachment to nature. And when he goes out there in southwestern Washington, in Aberdeen, and Hoquiam and that kind of area, where it was really the heart of the timber industry in that era, he meets somebody, a compatriot, who he has a soul.
They're soulmates.
They're soulmates. They really are.
Kindred spirits.
Yes, they are. In an old school sort of way, in a sort of D.H. Lawrence sort of way, I think. And they go and they want to, not only, they cut trees. That's what they do for a living. That's their job. But they also love the trees. So on off days, the two of them will go off and free climb trees. And I wanted them to be up in these trees, appreciating them and being with them as well as also sometimes cutting them down, kind of this weird dichotomy. So I needed to figure out, I said, I need to get up into a tree. In some of my, and I do research, I know I said, but I do read books for research. I was lying before. I read this really great book by Richard Preston called The Wild Trees, where he writes this, and I highly recommend it to you all, and I'm sure they have copies of it, Horizon Books, a fine independent bookseller. And they'll order copies if they don't have them. The wild trees, Richard Preston goes off with these guys who did the first explorations into the canopies of the redwood trees, non-invasively. Like, people had only studied redwoods from the ground or from above, but had to get into the canopies. So one of the guys who taught Richard Preston how to climb the trees is a guy named Tim Kovar in Oregon. He lives in Portland, Oregon, near me in Seattle. And so I called him up and I said, I need to get up in a tree. And he's like, no problem. So he started taking me up into trees. And last summer, he and I climbed an 850-year-old redwood tree in Santa Cruz.
What's it like up there?
It's amazing. I mean, it really is hyperbole is so easy this day and age, we toss it off. But it really is transformative in the way that, I don't know, yoga or, you know, something where you have a breakthrough in some sort of exercise regime or something, you realize you see it differently somehow at a certain point. I've climbed enough trees now to know that when I climb that redwood, the first 150, 120, 150 feet, there are no branches. So there's nothing there to protect you. You're climbing on a rope, you use ascenders. So, you know, there's a rope about as big as your thumb that you're going up. And I don't like heights. I have issues. So doing this with nothing there, but there's the great big tree. The tree is, you know, this big around. But you get about 100 feet up and you can look down. You're just kind of sitting in the saddle thing and you're going up like this. And you look down and if you look between your feet, you can see exactly where you're going to die. When the rope frays and breaks wherever it is attached, even though Tim is saying, no worries, I'm like, but I'm worried. But once you get above that, once you get into the canopy of the trees, it's like the branches are huge. Up near the top of a redwood, the branches are massive. And there's this, I made a video of it. It's on my website thing. You can see that how it kind of changes. And you can't see the floor of the forest anymore. And that's when you feel held by the tree. That's when you actually feel a relationship with the tree where it's, in a sense, giving you safety. It's holding you. And you regard the tree, when I did it, regarded the tree differently when I was up in it in that way. I felt it is a sentient being, but it has a very, very slow metabolism. Right? But it's been, how many days and nights has it seen? How many windstorms? How many lightning strikes? How many bugs and beetles? How many sunsets? How many seasons?
It's interesting how our worldview changes when we begin to have a relationship with something.
Yeah.
You refer to the tree as a sentient being.
Yeah. No, very much so. But with personal relationships as well, it's the same thing. But definitely I have had, you know, my epiphanies in trees. And so I wanted to bring that into the book. And so there are several climbing scenes in the book that I wanted to put in there because I think that, well, first of all, I it's an experience I recommend you all try. It's not, if you're sound mind and body, you can do it. It's a little strenuous, but it's not. I've climbed Mount Rainier before. I wouldn't recommend that to anyone. It's horrible, horrible experience.
There are a number of other relationships in this book, but when I was reading about Trevor, our precocious 14-year-old boy, I also thought about another character you created, Dean, who is central to your second novel, How Evan Broke His Head and Other Secrets.
That's right.
We've got teen boys. They're both stuck in very challenging family circumstances. Their fathers are hapless. Moms aren't anywhere to be found. On and on and on. And it made me wonder what it is about 14-year-old boys. You were one once, Oprah.
14-year-old boys, hapless fathers, and absent mothers. Well, doctor.
There's a continuity here. Is a cigar just a cigar? Is a Trevor just a Trevor? Or is there something here, Garth?
You know, If I could answer that question, I wouldn't write novels. I'd be a well-adjusted person, I'd have a regular job. I'm working out my problems in my stories. I mean, look, I don't even know. I don't try to reflect on stuff, and I don't even know, but I do have a friend of mine, an editor, very famous old editor guy in Berkeley, California, and he kind of is a little mentor for me, Alan Rinsler, and he reads my stuff, and he sent me an email after my last book, and he said, "What on earth happened between you and your mother when you were a child?"
Or your Aunt Serena.
Yeah, I don't reflect on it in that way. Really, maybe as in, self-denial, probably. I'm sure I'm working out a lot of issues. I don't do psychotherapy. But I'm sure there are some weird latent things but I don't think I want to know.
So the 14-year-old precocious teenage boy is not a prototype.
I am not an intellectual writer. I mean, if you're looking for Jeffrey Eugenides, that ain't me. So I am very visceral. Mm-hmm. I'm very from the gut is how I write, and I don't really worry about or think about how it could reflect upon me or the larger world, except in the sense that I think I want my books. I want to write a book that I have three sons, 18, 16, and 7 years old, and I would like my sons to be able to read my books and to get something out of them. Like to say, oh, that's how I, maybe if I do this, I can lead my life in a way that is somehow fulfilling or a benefit to me and to society at the same time. But I'm really, now that you think about it, 14-year-old kids, there are two of the 14-year-old boys. I find 14-year-old, the precipice of manhood is clearly something that is, I think is a very important time. It's the idea of being precocious, being, really well educated. My teenagers are so hyper well educated. I wish I could be. I want to take their classes at school. I want to can I go to and sit in your literature classes? They're reading such great stuff. They're having great conversations. They're like so smart and so attuned, and they haven't been poisoned yet by caffeine and alcohol, like you all have. They can still remember things, and yet. They're still very innocent in the way they still don't have the life experience to understand certain things. So there's a certain naivete, but there's the energy of trying to discover and yet not the understanding that what they discover may be painful. So I think that the 14-year-old, that era for me, that change, I see as something that's highly significant. So I guess I've written about it, and I'm going to try to write about someone older.
Well, then we'll...
Next time.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, Garth Stein reads from his book, A Sudden Light.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. The National Writer Series is a year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in downtown Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return now to Sarah Barrett Neal's conversation with novelist Garth Stein.
Well, let's talk about a character who's really the star of the universe here, if one trusts all the things one reads about you. Enzo the dog. Let's give it up for Enzo. Narrator of your third book.
Yes.
The Art of Racing in the Rain. Let's get right down to brass tacks. Who is he? Why is he called Enzo? Why is he race car obsessed? Enzo, by the way, is the narrator of this book. Go for
So Enzo, the idea of Enzo came in weird different ways, and it's one of those things that dropped in. When it finally came together, it dropped in fully intact. So when I used to make documentary films in New York, and I had seen a film about, that was made in Mongolia, about the belief among the nomadic people of Mongolia that the next incarnation for their dog will be as a person. And I thought that was really, I just loved the idea. And I thought, oh, I'm going to do something with that one day. And then years passed. And at that point I was living in New York, and then we'd moved back to Seattle with my kids. And I saw Billy Collins read some poetry. I don't know if you're familiar with Billy Collins. He's a great poet, and he was the U.S. Poet Laureate a number of years ago. And his poems are really fun, and you should check them out. And if he ever comes to the area, has he been here for this? You got to see him. He's got this great deadpan delivery, and he's got this real, you know, comic. He looks like a really tall Bob Newhart. Anybody who laughed is officially old. Anyway, he was reading his poem called The Revenant, which means words from the dead, which is told from the point of view of a dog who's recently been euthanized. So it's being narrated from doggy heaven. And the first line of the poem is this: I am the dog you put to sleep, as you like to call the needle of oblivion. Come back to tell you this simple thing: I never liked you.
I hate that poem. I think of, I hear those words every time I'm grouchy with my dogs.
It cracks me up. And I was like, I was sitting in this theater, and like everyone laughed, like you guys all laughed. Everyone laughed, and I thought, oh wait, that's my dog. My dog is like angry. He's like, I'm smarter than everybody else in the room, but no one listens to me because my tongue won't form words, and I can't go where I want to go because I don't have any thumbs. I can't turn doorknobs. So when I started writing Enzo, he morphed, he changed into, I learned who Enzo was. He was a much more gentle soul than Billy Collins' rather acerbic dog. Even so, there's a twist at the end of that poem. You should all check it out. So that's where Enzo kind of came from.
He's a very observant narrator. He seems to channel a lot of what he sees on the television for his worldview.
Right. This is important, yeah.
We get a keen sense of how much he would like to be human early in the book. Can I read
a little thing?
Okay. And this is advance warning. There's adult language ahead.
Oh.
Enzo says, monkeys have thumbs, practically the dumbest species on the planet, next to the duck-billed platypus. Yet, monkeys have thumbs. Those monkey thumbs were meant for dogs. Give me my thumbs, you f***ing monkeys. And that's classic Enzo, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a line Enzo cribbed from Scarface. But this is like, this is where, like, where do ideas come from? Everyone always wonders. And sometimes ideas come from the ether, or sometimes they come from something you read, or somebody says, or you know, like you pick up something somewhere. Sometimes ideas come out of, as Benjamin Franklin would say, out of necessity, right? Invention is 1% something, and 90, you know what I'm talking.
10%.
Whatever, 39%.
Yeah, that. Close enough.
Non-fat, non-hydrogenated soybean. Anyway, the point is that I was like, so I'm writing this book and I'm saying, okay, so I've got this dog, right? Okay, so I got that. And then his master's a race car driver, so I can bring the racing thing in. Okay, that's good. And then there's gonna be this whole drama thing. Got that. Okay, so now here's the thing. Enzo wants to be reincarnated as a human, as a person. Dogs aren't born with the intrinsic knowledge that they're going to come back as a person, right? That isn't something they're given at birth. He has to learn that. And how would he learn that? I was like, He's going to have to watch the documentary that I saw, State of Dogs. When I was making documentary films and I saw State of Dogs, and I was like, oh, that's a cool idea. He's going to have to see that. And how would he see that? Well, you know, when we had my dog, Comet, is 11 years old. And when she was she's a Labradoodle. But she's not like a real Labradoodle. You know, she's like a, you know, they do all these weird fancy crossback things. She's a back alley Labradoodle. You know, a lab and a poodle get together in a backstage and then Comet comes out. So the concept of a Labradoodle is you have all the best attributes of a lab and a poodle put together in a super dog. Yeah, Comet didn't get that. She's really not very smart, but don't tell her that. She's totally neurotic. She's very sweet though, but she's really insecure. And when she was a puppy, she would get freaked out if we would leave her alone in the house. So I would turn on the radio for her so she would have music or something to listen to. And then I thought, well, she shouldn't always listen to, you know, a certain kind of music. Maybe she should listen. And then I was like, well, you know, she probably should listen to some news to keep up, so NPR. And so I would switch the channels when we'd leave, so she would have a variety of. And then I thought, well, okay, so I can use that in this thing with Enzo. When Denny leaves Enzo at home, he'll leave the TV on for him, and then, but he doesn't want him to just only be fixated on racing. He'll change the channel sometimes to the Weather Channel or to the, you know, Discovery Channel or to National Geographic, and on National Geographic, maybe Enzo sees the documentary about the dog. So that's how this all came out. And then I thought, well, what else would he see? Well, of course, Denny, being a race car driver, would have like racing films on there. So the next thing you know, Enzo has been educated entirely by watching television. Law and Order, Le Mans, the great film with Steve McQueen, Grand Prix, you know, all these wonderful racing films, et cetera, et cetera.
Not unlike Chance the Gardener. Jerzy Kaczynski's.
That's right. Yes.
Being there.
We must tend the garden. Yes, yes. I like to watch.
I like to watch. Yes. Throughout the course of the book, Enzo expresses a lot of opinions about contemporary human life. And he's kind of part of a wonderful tradition of non-human animals reflecting on their two-legged counterparts. So what are the pros and cons of letting a dog narrate the story? Mostly, though, I want to know, can you send Enzo out there as your proxy? And can he say things that you might not want to say yourself?
Well, I think that a lot of the, that's an interesting and nuanced question. And let me say, I feel some amount of, not regret or dismay, those are almost too powerful, some amount of, what's ever less than regret or dismay, that the messages that Enzo puts out in the book are highly amenable to people, to readers, because they're being said by a dog. And that if a human character had said those, we would laugh them off. We would say they're silly. We would say, eh, that's ridiculous. You know, we should not think about the things that have already happened because we can't change them. Let's only think about the things in front of us that we can change. Let's focus on that. If a person were to say that in a book, you would say, oh, that's silly. Because we cling to a cynicism and a skepticism in our world where we don't, it's like we've almost lost a little faith that we are redeemable in a weird way. And yet Enzo puts these things out there and we say, oh yeah, of course, it makes sense. In a way, he brings the character of Enzo, I think, has connected with people, not because he's a dog, but because he's a brother from another planet, mm-hmm. You know? He's an outsider who's coming in to reflect upon this world, and we accept that because we say, oh, okay, so we can see this little bit of criticism. And you know, this is the kind of stuff that I've tried to do again in A Sudden Light, but taking it a step further. With A Sudden Light, the idea is, you know, it's a spiritual story. It's a ghost story, but it's my interpretation of a ghost story. It's a spiritual story. It's about trying to see the connections that are behind the facade that we all sort of agree on for convenience, like this, these dimensions that we agree on. We agree on these dimensions. Okay, we have four dimensions, great, that's good. We can all, we can limit our world to this, and we can box it up, and we can explain everything away. But if you go to the cutting edge of science and what people are thinking with string theory and with unified field theory and with quantum physics and mechanics and all this sort of stuff, and particle stuff, I mean, it's way beyond that. You go to read some Stephen Hawking, and he's talking about 18 dimensions, and we just can't see 14 of them. So who are we to presume that because we can't see those 14 dimensions, they don't have any impact on what's happening in our dimensions that we can see? So I really want to try and push that idea of being open. And I'm not trying to steer this away from Enzo, because I know we all love Enzo, but you know, the whole thing about A Sudden Light came about because when I was in the early stages of writing the book, of pushing the rock up the hill, and it was starting to tell me what it was about, that this was 5.5 years ago, then my father got very sick. And he got a very grave lung ailment that no one could explain. And he wasn't a guy who was gonna die young. He was 75 and he walked 4 miles a day and he did yoga twice a week. And he was a vibrant guy. Mm-hmm. But he got very sick, he had to go to the hospital and he was there for 3 weeks. And then he got sick from being in the hospital, as happens, as you many of you I'm sure know. He got secondary infections that only exist in the hospital. And then that snowballed, next thing you know, it was curtains for Marvin. And after he died, I got caught up in the experience of, in the business of death. If any of you have lost loved ones, I'm sure you know what this is like. You know, my mother was very distraught. My sister lives in California, and she wasn't really around for most of it. And so I was dealing with all the stuff. And I was good at it. I'm good at that stuff. But I wasn't really dealing with the fact that my father had died. So a few months after, I'm sorry to filibuster, but I want to tell you the story. A few months after my father died, I had a series of dreams. I had four dreams in a row, and they were very much the same, but not repetitive in any way. And in those dreams, my father came to me, and we had discussions. And some of them were about nothing, you know, banal, everyday recycling issues. And some were, you know, very serious, philosophical, grand idea stuff. And then at the end of the fourth night, he got up and left. And that was it. I haven't seen him since. Now, we can explain that away using science like we do with our four dimensions, and we can say, oh yeah, well, I was traumatized by my father's death, and I hadn't dealt with it, processed it properly, and so months later, I ate a bad piece of pepperoni pizza, and I had a little bit of food poisoning, and so random synapses fired in my head. And that's what happened, random chance occurrence.
Are you willing to accept that it was your father?
Oh, I guarantee you it was. See, I believe that we need to look beyond that containing it. I think we have to say, I interpret it as this. He did die prematurely, and he had stuff he wanted to say to me. And he wanted to come back and give me some message, and give me some ideas, give me some thoughts before he could go off on his journey. And so he came to me. What easier way is it for a person, for a spirit to reach us except in our sleep? In our sleep, our walls are down, right? Our cynicism that we cling to so hard isn't there. And the spirit doesn't have to manifest physically in any sort of special way. There's no cold air that has to blow through the room. No door has to slam or a bell ring or, my favorite, no soap message written on a window. So when you turn on the shower and get steamy, you see the message. None of that. They can just come to you. And so he came and he said what he needed to say, and then he was done with that. And you know, and I've told this story a bunch, and I guarantee you someone tonight is going to come up to me afterwards and is going to say, but it wasn't really a dream, was it? It seemed different, didn't it? It seemed more clear. It seemed, you remember it better. It seemed somehow more substantial, didn't it? And I say, yes. And then this person is going to say, that happened to me with my fill in the blank.
Spouse. I think it's notable that you were receptive. That all the ingrained things, the cultivated responses didn't kick in. So you make a good point about being asleep and that being a good time.
Well, I think we have to look out for
father.
That. I think we have to be on the. I think that if you look at all my books, with the exception of How Evan Broke His Head, which is more real, but that's something I was working out with, you know, my childhood. And we don't want to get into that. But you know, the magical realism I try to put in my books really is about trying to be open to seeing beyond the obvious. Like, we can all agree on the obvious, that's easy stuff. Let's try and peel back the layers and let's try and see those connections, because when those connections happen, I think we should take note of them. We shouldn't, we want to deny, we live in this like scientific world where we try and deny mysticism. I don't think we should. I think we should celebrate the mystical. It's there. There are many more dimensions than we can imagine.
Well, that's a wonderful segue to the next topic here, which is not a celebration of the mystical. The Art of Racing in the Rain has experienced some blowback.
No one told me.
That particular book's joined an august group.
Oh, yes.
Of books that people have tried to ban. Just as a point of reference, some banned books include Great Gatsby, Catcher in the Rye, and Captain Underpants. So, last year there was an attempt to remove The Art of Racing in the Rain from a high school literature yes. class in Braithwaite, Texas. Why and what's the status?
Yeah, in Dallas. There's a school district in Dallas that tried to, that removed, that banned The Art of Racing in the Rain, and I couldn't quite figure it out. And my initial theory was, it was among other books, there were seven books that they were putting the kibosh on, and one of them was Sherman Alexie's book, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. And I realized that they banned that book, and they probably looked at each other and said, shoot, man, everybody bans that book. Sherman's a friend of mine, it's okay. Everybody bans Sherman's book. We gotta do something really controversial. Let's ban The Art of Racing in the Rain.
There is sex in it.
There is sex. And so I said to my wife, my wife and I were trying to figure this out, and I said to her, she's like, why on earth would they ban your book? And I said, well, there's the allegation of sexual molestation of a statutory nature. I can imagine how that could be controversial among high school students. I can't really imagine that, but okay, I'll go with that. And she said, no, that's not it. She said, that's not it. And she thought about it for a minute, and she said, you know what I think it is? I think it's, there's a scene where Denny and Eve are making love, and Enzo's watching them, thus suggesting bestiality. And I said, really, that's kind of gross. And I said, do you think that's it? And she thought about it a little bit more. My wife's very smart. She thought about it a little more. She said, I don't think that's it.
So
she said, you read the beginning of the Monkey mm-hmm, Thumbs? Mm-hmm. And she said, in the Monkey Thumbs chapter, the chapter ends with Enzo commenting about a president of questionable moral and intellectual fortitude, which is clearly a swipe at George W. Bush, who's lived in Dallas for many years and still lives there now. And so they were obviously just protecting George W.
So
that's my wife's interpretation. I don't know.
It's a great conspiracy theory. At this point.
Give me one more. Come on.
Okay, we'll do this quickly.
I write novels, not haikus. We can't do anything quickly.
What degree did all this book burning, banning stuff cause you to grind your teeth?
Oh, not at all. As a matter of fact, it's a red badge of courage for me. Are you kidding? I'm banned. I'm banned in Texas. Yeah. No,
well,
look, I mean, that's like...
They gave you a reprieve.
Yeah, no, but it's still being contested. It went before, it got a reprieve, and it went before the review panel, and it was voted 10-1 to reinstate the book as part of the curriculum. I don't know who the one was. And immediately it was contested again, and it's now currently under review again. So, you know, look, I mean, I think that... I find it a little bit of an affront, quite frankly. I mean, it's kind of fun in a weird way because it's this one school district, and I go, ha, ha, ha. But the fact of the matter is, what are we doing in this? What are we doing in our society? We have a system that we theoretically believe in, don't we? Which is having our children schooled by paid professionals who are trained. I mean, trained teachers of English and science and math who are working on our behalf so that we can go to work and do what we do and we can have our kids go, not, we could teach them at home, sure, we could all homeschool our kids. It's gonna limit the amount of time we can do our own stuff and all that. It changes the whole dynamic. But the fact is, we want our kids to go off into a social situation where they can be with their peers mm-hmm. and they can be guided through discussions about difficult subjects by, guess what? Paid professionals who we have entrusted with the education of our children. So I don't get it. So how can we then pull the rug out from under our teachers and say, oh, that book that you want to teach because you think it has a lot of provocative thoughts and it teaches something in a good way that really engages the students and they want to talk about and they want to read and they want to have more discussion about, and no, you can't have that. Actually, that's the one thing you can't have. Teach them something that's really boring and that they don't want to read and that stifles discussion. How about that? It's just not right. So, I mean, look, I have strong feelings. Really strong feelings.
Garth, why don't you...
I gotta say more.
Okay, say that, but
no,
you need to read.
I'm gonna read right now. I'm gonna read, and as I'm turning to my page, I'm just gonna say, we need to... the undervalued in our communities, we have to respect and recognize, and those are your teachers, your librarians, your booksellers. So please, thank you.
Well done.
I'm gonna read now. I'm just gonna read like this first page. I'm gonna read quick, right? You guys are happy though. You're kind of a lively crowd, aren't you? This is the prologue of A Sudden Light, The Curse. Growing up in rural Connecticut, I had been told the name Riddell meant something to people in the Northwest. My paternal great-great-grandfather was someone of significance, my mother explained to me. Elijah Riddell had accumulated a tremendous fortune in the timber industry, a fortune that was later lost by those who succeeded him. My forefathers had literally changed the face of America with axes and two-man saws and diesel donkeys to buck the fallen. With mills to pulp the corpses and scatter the ashes, they carved out a place in history for us all. And that place, I was told, was cursed. My mother, who was born of English peasant stock on the peninsula of Cornwall, made something of herself by following her passion for the written word, eventually writing the dissertation that would earn her a PhD in comparative literature from Harvard University, and becoming the first in her family to receive an advanced degree. Though she never did anything of note with her brilliance, she did carry it around with her like a seed bag, sprinkling handfuls of it on what she deemed fertile soil. She spent much time quoting literature to me when I was young, thus sparking my own avid reading habits. So the theme of the Ancient Mariner and his story, as told by the poet and philosopher Samuel Taylor Coleridge, and how the Mariner's story was emblematic of my family's history, was something I had heard often before my 14th birthday. The curse. When one destroys something of beauty and nature, as did the mariner, who shot the kindly albatross that led his ship out of the perilous Antarctic seas, one will be punished. My mother told me this, my father nodded when she did. Punishment will rain down upon the offender and the family of the offender, I was told, until the debt is settled. The debt owed by my family has been paid, and then some. But there is no tidy end to any story, as much as we might hope. Stories continue in all directions, to include even the retelling of the stories themselves, as legend is informed by interpretation, and interpretation is informed by time. And so I tell my story to you as the mariner told his, he standing outside the wedding party, snatching at a passing wrist, paralyzing his victim with his gaze, I standing with my family at the edge of this immortal forest. I tell this story because telling the story is what I must do. 20-some years ago, before technology changed the world and terrorism struck fear into the hearts of all citizens, before boys in trench coats stalked and murdered classrooms full of innocent children in schools across this fair land, before the oceans were thick with oil slicks and the government ceased to govern, and Bill Gates set out to love the world to death, and hurricanes became powerful enough to stagger entire cities, and toxic children were drugged into oblivion to drive up the profits of big pharma, and genetically modified foodstuffs were forced upon us without us knowing we needed to care. Before smoking marijuana at gay marriages became passé, before gay people became eh, just like anyone else, and weed became eh, just another source of tax revenue. This was even before another famous bill, the one surnamed Clinton, became famous for his choice of cigars. It seems like ages ago, looking back on it, no smartphones, no on-demand, nary an iPad in sight. So long ago, yes, this story begins in 1990.
Thank you. Just a simple family tale.
Just a little tale about what it's like to be alive today. We're going to take questions now.
I just wanted to make a comment, how I ended up with your book, The Art of Racing in the Rain. My husband, who is a professional educator, they make those choices of what literature we read, he purchased that book for me. I had started a running program, and we had a golden retriever, and so he thought it was a book about running. So he gave it to me because we have a golden retriever, and it's similar to the face of Enzo.
So what grade does he teach?
He was, fortunately, he was history and geography, so didn't have to worry about literature.
No worries.
So as I started to read it, I leaned over to him, and I said, this book is about NASCAR. And so we've had a good joke about that over the years, but I did truly, truly love the story.
Okay. Well, thank you. And let me just clarify, because now I actually got that little dig in on your husband, and it was all in good fun. So now I have to give a little dig to you. It's not about NASCAR. See, because hold on. Because in NASCAR, as you well know, they don't race in the rain. So I would have had to change the title to The Art of Sitting Around in the Garage in the Rain.
Thank you, Garth Stein. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Don't forget to pick up your book in the lobby along with your free dog biscuit. And see you next time. Thank you again, you guys.
Thank you.
That was Garth Stein talking with Sarah Barrup-Neal. Garth Stein's latest book is A Sudden Light. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org. And listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For IPR, I'm Linnea Melkerich.